Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with 3 14-year-old members of Joyology, a school-based club in Carlisle created to spread positivity, acceptance, joy, and kindness. The founder, Adeline Moreland, started the group in 6th grade, and she's headed to high school next year. But first, Andrew Ritker wrote The Altruists, his debut novel, between the ages of 23 and 25. So it's not surprising that he captures the angst that so many people experience in their early 20s, but he also writes about baby boomers with incredible insight, empathy, and humor. He graduated from the Iowa Writers' Workshop in May and is on the line with me now from his home in Brooklyn. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And let's talk first, before we kind of dig into the plot of the novel, let's talk about your inspiration for this book. Where did the idea come from?
Well, I had just graduated college, and this was 2014, so not too many years after the big recession. And I'm not a sociologist, and I wouldn't, you know, want to put this down on paper, but it certainly seemed to me at the time, I had the impression that friends were spinning out in sort of one of two directions. Some seemed to be heading off to work in the financial industry and make piles of money, and others went in a very different direction to sort of do social justice projects. But both camps seemed kind of in this weird ethical bind where the finance, you know, kids were sort of, to me at least at that age, I felt that they were sort of implicated in this process that had led to the recession. But then the kids doing things like Teach for America would report back and say, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm in over my head. You know, the schools are underfunded. I might be doing more harm than good. I don't know what I'm doing here. And so I found myself kind of caught between these questions of how do you make a living? How do you make the world a better place? Are those things incompatible? And just sort of staring down the sort of post-collegiate future, all those questions were really sort of the germ of the novel.
And let's talk about this novel, because just saying that doesn't give us really much idea of the depth and breadth of the lives that you explore in this book. But it all revolves around one family, the Alters. And I think first, I mean, why don't you tell us a little bit about Arthur Alter, the father of this family?
Yeah, so Arthur is the family patriarch, and he's sort of a man almost living in the wrong era. He was inspired by my love of the sort of post-war novels by Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, where you have these sort of narcissistic, prickly male anti-heroes, essentially. But I wanted to see what it would look like if a character like that found himself in 2015, and he had to sort of share space with his family in the novel. And so when the novel opens, he is struggling to pay his mortgage. His wife has been dead for 2 years, and he's really struggling financially. And she has passed on her sort of secret stash of savings to her children. So he is estranged from his children and not the most generous guy, not exactly an ideal family man, but he has sort of taken it upon himself now to reconnect with his kids with the sort of ulterior motive of maybe asking them if they could reroute the inheritance back up to him so he could save the mortgage on the family home.
And he is a professor or an instructor at a private college in St. Louis. And this is the organization that he went to with high hopes years before, thinking that he would be on a tenure track through the years and get a nice solid professorship and age into a distinguished older age. And that is not what happened. So, like, I mean, and this feels really true from a lot of people I know living in academia, although a lot of it's his own fault and not everybody is at fault, but where you wind up not on a tenure track, he's teaching fewer and fewer classes every year. He goes from being paid like a professor gets paid to being paid like an adjunct.
Yeah, a lot of what I wanted to explore with this book were the sort of ways in which these ideas about the American dream and upward mobility and homeownership and all these things are sort of retirement are, you know, not always don't always come true. And it started with me and my generation and people my age and seeing that, yeah, home ownership, property ownership, these are almost pipe dreams for a lot of people my age. But also, too, for older generations, you know, you can't retire like you used to. You can't expect the same things you used to. And so it was interesting for me to put a baby boomer character in a position that a lot of millennials, but I think also older folks find themselves in now, too, where that expectation of a cushy retirement or tenure, these things are a lot more tenuous than they used to be.
Tell me a little bit about Francine, his departed wife.
So Francine is, in a lot of ways, the true altruist of the novel. She, unlike her husband, she doesn't embark on a grand scheme to, you know, save the world, or like her daughter similarly, but she is this sort of kind, generous, self-sacrificing person who finds herself kind of swept up in Arthur's ambitions, and as a result moves back to the Midwest where she grew up and hoped not to return to, and now she sort of finds herself there again. But the interesting thing about Francine is that she's pretty much deceased for the majority of the novel, at least in the present day, but the novel goes into the past of all these characters, and so she's a family therapist, she's a couples therapist, and the novel sort of plays therapist and digs into these characters' past. So you see Francine as a child, you see her growing up, and you basically see all the sort of small sacrifices that accrued in her life that she made in service of her family. And at some point along the way, she comes into this money that she will eventually reroute to her children as this sort of final act of defiance against her husband.
And although this was a final act of defiance, and Arthur had been largely absent as a father, they had remained married. And I'm not going to say it seemed like a particularly happy marriage, but things were going okay. Until just about the time when she gets her cancer diagnosis.
Yeah. So on the day before she gets her cancer diagnosis, Arthur begins an affair with a younger colleague, and he makes pains to point out that the affair began before the diagnosis. But once the diagnosis comes to light, he continues the affair, and she sort of finds out because, out of the guilt over the affair, he starts treating his wife Francine almost too nicely.
Much better than he's ever treated her in their entire marriage.
That's the tip off to her. Exactly. Exactly.
So the two of them have two children. And again, as I mentioned, Arthur was pretty much an absentee father through most of their lives. But let's start with the older child, Ethan, the son of the family. Tell me a little bit about him.
Yeah, when the novel opens, Ethan has been living this kind of life of seclusion. He worked in the financial industry, and then when the money from his mother came in, he quit his job and sort of, yeah, secluded himself, almost living like a hermit in this very expensive apartment in Brooklyn. And little does his father know, but he's spent all of his mother's money, and in fact, more than that, he's run up a hefty credit card debt, and he's got this kind of almost addiction to consumerism, so he fills up his house with, you know, electric corkscrews and all kinds of, you know, Williams Sonoma home gadgets and things that he doesn't really need, and basically has been living this life of seclusion. But he's also got this almost tragic history where he had a relationship with another man in college, and that didn't end particularly well, and that's been haunting him all this time. So he's a little bit of a trapped inside his past, trapped inside his apartment, trapped inside his debt.
And his sister, Maggie.
And his sister, Maggie, she is kind of constitutionally Ethan's opposite. She's very engaged with the world. She's what you might call now a social justice warrior sort of figure. She is really interested in politics, really interested in very idealistic, ideological. And at the same time, she is not necessarily alert to, or rejects rather, the sort of hypocrisies that you know, make the world turn. So she, for instance, tutors these two young boys, and she charges them a dollar, kind of like a swear jar, anytime they misbehave. But in order to charge the family of the boys so little, she's forced to then pilfer money from the swear jar. And so she kind of finds herself caught between her ideals and reality.
And from what you were saying earlier about your inspiration for the book, was Maggie the first character that came into your mind, this young idealist trying to make a difference in the world and not doing a very good job of it?
Yeah, absolutely. She was the first character, and she really, all the characters are sort of comic characters in a way, but she really does represent, to me, some serious issues that I myself was going through, thinking about how to make the world a better place and not starve and all of these questions. She really embodies to me a really noble spirit, but someone who's maybe also not fully awake to the various sacrifices people have to make or the various compromises people have to make to live the kind of life she wants to live.
Right. She sees others, although she has a lot of sympathy for those in need, she doesn't have any sympathy for those who are not in need, for people who she feels are not living a virtuous life.
Right. And in some ways, she doesn't even have sympathy for herself. She says at one point, it's the duty of people with privilege to make life hard on themselves, because if you don't, you wind up with a sort of spoiled, rotten core. But she sort of imposes difficulty on herself in an almost, she sort of half ironically compares herself to Mother Teresa at some point. She's got this kind of martyrdom savior complex, but doesn't exactly know how to best shape the world to her vision of it.
Right. And she's actually doing damage to herself by this method. So she's not really helping anybody. She's hurting herself. And as the novel really gets underway, this family has been estranged for 2 years. Ethan and Maggie are in New York. They have not spoken to their father for 2 years. And he's having this crisis that leads him to invite the kids to come home. And we will sort of pick up there in just a moment. I'm talking to Andrew Ridker. He is the author of The Altruists. It is his debut novel. He wrote it between the ages of 23 and 25. He just graduated from the Iowa Writers Workshop. And this novel talks about a family, but it spans generations, and it also makes you laugh. We'll talk more in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in just a few minutes, we will meet some young joyologists from Carlisle. Right now, I'm talking with Andrew Ridker. He is the author of the novel The Altruists, and he just graduated from the Iowa Writers Workshop in May. This is his debut novel, and he wrote it between the ages of 23 and 25, inspired by the angst he was feeling, and he saw many of his friends experiencing in their early 20s, but that angst in the novel covers many generations, actually. And Andrew, so we talked about all of the different characters before the break, but I want to ask you, mentioned, I don't want to play sociologist, but in this novel, you really dig deep into the psyche of each individual character. And there were moments where I'm like, oh, yeah, I read about that in my psychology class. So is this a hobby for you? Is this something that comes naturally to you to sort of explore the psyche of people?
Well, I think most writers, especially writers working in a character-based vein, and I definitely consider myself to be someone who focuses primarily, before plot, before theme, before any of these things, I focus really on character. It's important to get to know these people, not just who they are today and where they're going, but where they've been. And it helped to have Francine, the matriarch, be a family therapist, because it sort of allowed me to borrow some of that language of her profession in my own sort of analysis of the characters. I will say, though, that I was not a psychology major. I have no background in it, but I do think there is a certain something where growing up in a Jewish family where this almost casually psychoanalytic language gets tossed around, and I grew up in around people where it was very common to sort of throw off these armchair diagnoses or casually drop this kind of language. So it was always in the air, even if no one in my family had read a page of Freud, that language trickles down in the culture somewhere and you kind of find yourself playing that game a little bit with other people. Yeah.
When I read the dust jacket of the book and saw how young you are, I'll have to admit that I was a little bit skeptical going into the novel, just thinking how can he write about all of these characters realistically? But both Arthur and Francine, they felt like people that I know. They felt like real people. And you seem to have a really incredible understanding of their feelings, given their much longer lives and the challenges that they face. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I suppose it comes from observation, which is the sort of step that comes before writing. Growing up, I had friends who were, millennials, and then I had my parents' generation, baby boomers. And that's, I think, for a long time, in a weird way, I didn't even know that other generations existed. I was kind of in my house and in the houses of all my friends. It was like, this is the parental generation, and this is the kids generation, and that's the binary. And so I grew up just very much, observing people of that generation, just as I was people my own age. But on a certain level too, writing is a project, writing fiction, at least for me, is a project of getting outside of myself and imagining other people's lives. And, through these lenses of gender or sexuality or age or generation, people are still people, and they make decisions based on what they feel their, wants, needs, desires are. And so on some level, to me, that's the sort of project of fiction, is creating someone who's credibly different from yourself, but also finding that common humanity and thinking, what would I do in that situation, even if I'm not exactly demographically just like the characters?
So getting into the mindset of a woman in her late 50s, did you recruit any readers to help you sort of figure out if that rang true?
Well, I suppose not readers, but I did. I certainly talked to my own mother quite a bit about her experiences. They're not by any stretch, verbatim what appeared in the book, but
I hope not. Right.
Right, exactly. And that's the trick of writing sort of darkly funny, slightly satirical mode, is people, never want to see their lives showing up on the page in the least flattering ways. But we definitely had long talks about what was it like to, be a mother, be a new mother, or, what was it like give birth, even, just having these kind of frank discussions. It's sort of a form of research, rather than go to the library and hit the textbooks, you sort of go out and talk to people in the world. But on the other hand too, I don't know what it's like to be a middle-aged woman who sacrifices something for her husband's career, but I know what it's like to sacrifice something. And so you sort of take that that common emotion and apply it to a different circumstance.
The book is very funny, and there is a lot of dark humor in the book, but you also manage to balance that with heart. When I first heard about the plot of the book, I thought, I'm going to hate all of these people because they all sound like terrible human beings. But you find the humanity in everyone. So as you were writing, how do you balance the humor with the humanity?
That's a great question. I love writing, prickly characters that might be not someone you want to hang out with in real life, but at least for me, someone you'd want to voyeuristically sort of watch their lives unfold on the page. I love an antihero. I love a train wreck. I love people who get into trouble, create their own trouble. But it did become very important that the novel was not just some sort of one-note exercise in satire or humor. I mean, I think it would be rare for an author to create characters out of thin air just to sort of beat up on them. And that certainly wasn't my goal. And I personally had a lot of affection for these characters. So for me, it was a question of digging into their past and seeing how, if they appear maybe slightly unlikable at the present, what got them there? And, they were a child once, they were a young person once, like what happened in their life to get them here? And it's almost sort of through excavating people's past that you sort of get a more three-dimensional picture and find yourself maybe reserving judgment or even revising a judgment you might have made of the characters, you know, 30 pages earlier.
Now, I've heard that you used to do stand-up comedy. Tell me about that.
Yeah, not stand-up, actually. I did sketch and improv comedy in high school and college, not to split hairs. But, that was a big activity for me when I was younger. It's something that I cringe at a little bit now because I think, no one wants to look back on what they thought was funny and in ninth grade. It is something that, you know, I got into the spirit of, you know, improv especially teaches you to be very quick on your feet. And there's a parallel, I think, between any improvisational art and writing, which is that you don't have a plan, you go in not knowing what you're doing, and you kind of have to accept ideas as they come. And so there is a lot to learn, I think, from improv about how to keep yourself open to circumstance and not overburden your writing with plans. But comedy generally has always been so important to me. And I need, for me, the way into a novel, comedy is, it's a way to create intimacy. If I can make a reader laugh, you know, I have them on my side. And if a book can make me laugh, I'm immediately drawn in, because something about making people laugh just, it's almost like a shortcut to a very profound kind of intimacy. You skip the small talk, you know, you don't have to have hours and hours of conversations. If you can just make someone laugh, all of a sudden you're on the same page. And that's a very important thing for me when I'm reading books, but also when I'm writing.
I'm talking with Andrew Ritker. He is the author of The Altruists. And speaking of humor, the very funniest thing in the book, in my opinion, is not even really part of the plot. It just, you learn about it a couple of times in an ancillary way. But there, one of the characters knows someone who has created an app, and it's a dating app where people go online and create profiles and share all of the trauma they experienced. Like if they had to have an expander in their mouths when they were in seventh grade, that's a shared trauma. And of course, up to the bigger stuff, and they get matched up by trauma. This totally tickled my funny bone, but where did that idea come from?
Well, yeah, I think we're in a moment now where on the one hand, people are much more enabled to speak publicly about various traumas, large and small, in their life, and that's a wonderful thing. And at the other end of the spectrum, there's an almost this idea of the commodification of trauma, or how can, you know, we take our traumas and try to not just get them off our chest or make them public, but even possibly profit off of them. And so I like this idea that there would be a dating app that could really genuinely create these, you know, bonds between people. I mean, there's some line in the book, but the theory behind the dating app being that, you know, for instance, two veterans of the same war might have more in common with each other than someone who simply likes the same movie as someone else, or whatever else you'd fill out on your Tinder profile. But that the guy who's created the app is also sort of under scrutiny for sharing all this data. And there are privacy questions, and people are obviously out there sharing their most vulnerable things. So it probably grew out of this new wave, I think, of disclosure that you see, especially on social media, especially on apps, where people are very emboldened, sometimes wonderfully, and sometimes in a way that makes me slightly uncomfortable, to just, you know, publicly post a trauma of any kind. And I thought it could be a funny idea to sort of play with this almost sinister app that could potentially find your soulmate, and could also potentially be, you know, selling your data about the worst thing that ever happened to you to some third party. I thought it was a kind of way in to talk about these identitarian issues that didn't pick a side, but just sort of, you know, sent up the whole thing.
But did you trademark the idea? Because somebody's going to make this.
I know. I was talking to someone about it, and it really does feel like pretty near future, like any month or year now. You know, that's going to be a new feature of Tinder or something. It'll be, you know, your physical details, your favorite books and movies, and then, you know, the absolute worst thing that ever happened to you. I'm sure it's on the horizon.
Or the 10 worst things. Yes, absolutely.
The 10 worst things, right.
And you could have been making all that money, but now you're not going to. So I'm sorry about
no,
that.
No, I've picked a very I picked a much more destitute literary path, unfortunately.
So, as I mentioned earlier, you just graduated from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, but you wrote this novel before you got into the workshop, right?
Right, right.
Okay, so tell me about that timeline. That's an unusual way to go.
It was one of the strangest weeks of my life. I sold the novel. I heard back from Sam Chang, the director of the workshop, that I had been accepted. And days later, I heard that I had sold the novel. And I, you know, it was a total rains it pours kind of situation. I was overwhelmed. And I had that choice to make where it was sort of like, well, the novel is sold, you know, and a lot of people said, why would you go off to grad school? You've already done it. You can, you know, this can be your life now. But I genuinely felt that I still had more to learn. I wanted to be in a place that was supportive to writers. You know, they give you 2 years of almost uninterrupted time to really just focus. And I just knew there were things I wanted to get better at. And I didn't want to say, you know, just because I wrote one book, you know, I'm done learning. And so it was important for me to go out there and learn from people and meet the other young writers at the program. So it was it turned out to be a great experience, but definitely one that I wasn't sure if I should take after the news of the book hit.
Absolutely. So what do you think you got out of the experience? Because again, it's different than what many of your classmates were getting.
Yeah. It's a bit different. And in another sense, I think we're all sort of there, you know, when you turn in your work every week or every couple weeks to workshop, it doesn't matter if you have a book deal. It doesn't matter if you've written a book or never written, you know, more than two short stories before. You've got a group of about 12 people training their eyes very closely on some excerpt of 20 pages of a, you know, Microsoft Word document. And so kind of all the other stuff falls away. You know, you're in Iowa, the New York publishing machine is very far away. You're in a sort of beautiful room with a great view of just nature, and you're all the other stuff outside sort of doesn't matter. And so you're evaluated just like you'd be your work would be evaluated. Yeah. Whether you had a book or not. So for me, it was about just getting smart people, to look at my work and give me feedback and meeting other young writers. The project I'm working on currently has definitely been helped along and inspired by other writer friends who I've met at the program.
So in the 2 years that you were in Iowa, what's the product that came out of that? Do you have another book on the horizon?
Yeah, on the horizon is probably the way to put it. I have another book in progress, another novel. It's coming along. It was really nice to be able to set aside, you know, real life to focus on it for a couple years. It's not finished yet. I'm hoping to maybe have a draft by the end of the year. But it was once stuff for The Altruist started picking up, I had to put it on hold. So I'm back in New York now and just getting back to working on it. And, you know, the closed door and the sort of solitude that you need to really get good work done. I'm finally getting back to that again.
Well, the one of the plots in The Altruist, as you mentioned earlier, is that this family moves to St. Louis. So they moved to the Midwest, and the mother was from the Midwest. She never wanted to go back to the Midwest, and here they were. So you were doing a lot of juxtaposing Midwestern life with life in New York in the novel. And then as soon as you got your publishing contract, you moved to Iowa. Were there moments that were a little surreal during those 2 years that echoed your book?
Yeah, I think because it originally had been written in part because I had grown up outside Boston, and then I went to St. Louis for college, and that sort of culture clash and observing those, you know, geographical cultural differences. But then, yeah, I sort of started to see it played out all over again, because after college, I went to New York and then back to Iowa. So I've done all this sort of ping-ponging between East Coast and Midwest. And it really is, you know, kind of a sharply pronounced cultural difference, I think. I mean, I think there are broad stereotypes about the East Coast and the Midwest, and probably a grain of truth to each. But they seem to be these two kinds of places that very much misunderstand each other. And I wanted to explore that. And especially now, in this political moment where people talk so much about the bubble, or, you know, people living in these sort of enclosed ideological spaces, it was really valuable for me to be to split my time in different parts of the country, because I think it widened what would have been otherwise a very, you know, a much narrower ideological vision I would have had of the country.
Well, Andrew, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Andrew Ridker, he is the author of The Altruist. It is his debut novel, and it's about a family that lived in St. Louis. There are generation gaps. There are painful truths about idealism, and it's also funny. So heart-wrenching and hilarious at the same time. Coming up in just a moment, I'm going to talk with three 14-year-old members of the group Joyology. It's a school-based club in Carlisle that is designed to spread positivity, acceptance, joy, and kindness. That's coming up in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.